From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Back in 1985, Joe Kane agreed to write about a group of explorers trying to make the first end-to-end trip down the Amazon River. Kane was one of only two men who completed the journey, and it nearly cost him his life. On this edition of Fresh Air, Down the Amazon with Joe Kane. Marta Renzi doesn't like the kind of dance that says, "Look at me, I'm beautiful." Coming up, the choreographer and dancer describes her alternative. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Peter Sellers' staging of three Mozart operas. And commentator Maureen Corrigan relives the travails of her latest move. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The House Ethics Committee will be reviewing more than 200 charges against House Minority Whip Newt Gingrich when the probe gets underway. Democrat Bill Alexander told NPR he will file the new charges with the committee in addition to the original accusations about Gingrich's alleged unethical behavior in connection with plans to publish a book. Alexander said the new charges concern unethical and possible illegal activities on the part of Gingrich. President Bush expressed fears for the safety of Americans held in hostage in Lebanon today, but offered no response yet to the killing by pro-Iranian Shiites of William Higgins. The president said he is still trying to gather more information.
We're leaving no stone unturned, but regrettably, you know, sir, we're dealing with less than a full deck when it comes to information. It is very hard when you're dealing with this kind of cowardice and this kind of dastardly act to get all the information that you need to make a decision.
Bush sought help from more world leaders today and for the third time in 3 days met with top military, diplomatic, and national security advisors in the cabinet room to review developments in Lebanon. The White House said no further sessions are scheduled. A coalition of groups wants federal laws requiring teachers to be taught to identify and help prevent child abuse. Allison Keyes of member station WBEZ has more.
The National Committee for Prevention of Child Abuse surveyed 480 teachers across the nation. They found 70% have suspected a student is being abused, but most feel unqualified to do anything about it. Dr. Ann Cohn says that means much abuse is going unreported by school officials.
I would just cite that perhaps certainly the most notable case, the most well-known case, but in any ways the most poignant case of all, and that's the Lisa Steinberg case.
Cohn says Steinberg, a New York child abuse victim, is an example of how teachers sometimes miss signs of obvious abuse. The groups are also pushing for federal laws mandating no corporal punishment in schools. So far, 19 states have outlawed letting teachers physically punish students. For National Public Radio, I'm Allison Keyes in Chicago.
The federal government today announced charges against 46 people in its two-and-a-half-year probe of illegal trading schemes and tax fraud at the Chicago Board of Trade and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. The investigation resulted in charges that traders conspired to skim profits from customer accounts and tried to hide the profits from the Internal Revenue Service. The government said directors of the Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange were not involved in any of the illegal activity and had cooperated in the investigation. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 16 points today to close at 2657.44. Advances led declines 8 to 7 on volume of 182 million shares. The average price of a share gained 8 cents. This is NPR News. The families of 137 passengers killed when a Korean Airlines jet was shot down by a Soviet fighter plane were awarded $50 million today by a federal jury in Washington. The jury decided on punitive damages 2 hours after returning a verdict that KAL had committed willful misconduct in the incident, which resulted in the deaths of all 269 people on board Flight 007. Without the finding of willful misconduct, the families would have been limited to compensation of $75,000 per passenger, a figure set by international treaty. Argentina today lifted a ban on trade with Great Britain that has been in effect since the two countries clashed over the Falkland Islands 7 years ago. David Wellner reports the move by Argentina's new Peronist government is aimed at restoring full diplomatic relations with London.
It's been 4 years since Great Britain dropped its ban on trade with Argentina, but only now has Argentina reciprocated. The official announcement by the Argentine Foreign Ministry said the sanctions were being lifted in the interest of stimulating foreign trade. But the move also underscored Argentine President Carlos Menem's stated desire to reestablish diplomatic relations with Great Britain, which have been broken since the two countries battled over the Falkland Islands in 1982. Although recovering Argentine control of the islands was a banner of Menem's presidential campaign, since taking office last month, the Peronist leader has concentrated on rescuing Argentina's economy from near collapse. Restoring ties with England is considered essential for bringing in badly needed loans. For National Public Radio, I'm David Wellner reporting.
A congressional report released today warns that the space shuttle will be lost and astronauts will die within the next decade if the United States carries out its vision of reaching unexplored parts of the universe. The study by the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment said that if such risks are to be perceived too high, the nation may decide to reduce its emphasis. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. Joe Kane's journey down the Amazon River started with a phone call from a stranger. The caller hoped to be the first man to navigate the 4,200-mile length of the Amazon. He was organizing an expedition, and he was looking for a writer to chronicle the journey. At the time, Joe Kane was writing for a San Francisco newspaper and for the Coevolution Quarterly. He decided to join the expedition. Joe Kane has just finished the book about the trip. It's called Running the Amazon. Kane was the only American in the 10-person team, and several of the 9 other members shook the little confidence he had. The leader of the expedition was slightly crippled from polio and had a reputation for sloppily planned trips. One of the members had chronic brucellosis, a condition that often left him depressed, extremely lethargic, and feverish. Another man was 52, had a degenerating disc, an arthritic hip, and was overweight. Only Joe Kane and one other man paddled the full length of the river. I asked Kane what he expected his role to be when he joined the expedition as the writer.
At first, at least the way it was presented to me when I was going down there, was that I wasn't supposed to do anything. In fact, I was supposed to shadow the expedition by truck. There was supposed to be a big escort vehicle that would rendezvous with the kayakers every 2 to 3 weeks. And I was simply supposed to chronicle the expedition. I had no duties outside of that. However, once I landed in Peru, I realized that in essence, I had been sold a bill of goods. There was no expedition vehicle. Eventually, the man who was to later become the expedition leader, Piotr Malinsky, rounded up a Land Rover. Clearly, that couldn't hold me, and it couldn't hold the other expedition members it was supposed to carry. And we wound up hiking the first 150 miles of the river on foot, all in the high Andes up above 15,000 feet. At that point, my role in the expedition started to shift. Actually, it shifted right from the start in Peru in that I was assigned to help coordinate food supplies with another Polish man, Zbigniew Bizdak, who was our photographer. Later, when we got down into the big Whitewater Gorge, I was the quartermaster. I was in charge of making sure that we had supplies and that food was equally distributed and that there was no mildew in the bags and things like that. It was the lowest work on the expedition, without a doubt. But it became my means of establishing myself within the expedition and not simply as an outsider.
When you realized that you'd been sold a false bill of goods, why didn't you just leave?
That's a good question. Well, partially in a very crass way, I was on the hook. I owed these thousands of dollars to people, and I had made a deal with the publisher. But on a more, on a deeper level, I was in. You know, I had the bit in my mouth. I got sick right away in Peru, and as soon as I got over that, I started thinking, boy, I am in a different kind of place. This is my fantasy. I left home really on the run and not sure what I was looking for, but just knowing that I was bored silly with my life. You know, I had a girlfriend, and we would probably get married soon. I had a job that was steady, if nothing else, and fairly interesting. I was with the old Coevolution Quarterly, and it was a fun crew. But when I got right down to it, I was bored silly, and I realized that it was a matter of there just not being enough in my life that was raw. You know, everything seemed so cut off. So although the expedition clearly had huge problems from the get-go, we were flat broke before we even got on the river. At the same time, here was an experience that I couldn't walk away from, and, mm-hmm. and being a writer especially, I knew that there was a story there, and I wanted to chase it. It was simple as that, I think.
You got to the source of the Amazon high in the Andes, and that's where the official expedition began. But you'd already suffered through mountain sickness before you got on the Amazon. Would you describe what the source of the Amazon looked like to you when you approached it?
Well, for us, And I think for anybody, the source, you have to say it's more symbolic than real. You really can't point to a square foot of ground and say, this is where the Amazon starts. We climbed right to the continental divide, the South American continental divide, climbed to 18,000 feet. It was a high tundra, I suppose would be a good description of it. It was a glacier, or had been a glacier, and now it, with changing weather conditions, had degenerated to a snowfield. And we simply went over the continental divide, only a matter of a few hundred yards, and found an ice fall there, a frozen sheet of white ice, probably 25 feet high, and called that the source of the Amazon. It reached it reached the proportions, or the extent that one of the guys climbed up on the top of the ice fall and spit over the side and said, well, that makes me the source of the Amazon. You can't narrow it down any more than that. And then the idea was to follow the runoff until it built a body of water that would support kayaks, and then from there to run it 4,200 miles out to the Atlantic.
Well, I guess as Joe Kane, author of the new book, Running the Amazon, well, you had to negotiate a lot of rapids along your journey through the Amazon. Would you describe the worst rapid that you had to run?
Sure. In a way, for 6 weeks, it felt like we were running one continuous rapid. I should describe just what the river does through there. It it drops that 18,000 feet in about 600 miles. And at one point, it runs through a gorge that's 10,000 feet deep, which is twice as deep as the Grand Canyon. It runs at a gradient of about five times the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon, all of which meant nothing to me. I had never been on a whitewater river. I had never been in a raft or a sea kayak. I had intertubed on the Sacramento River in California, trailing a six-pack of beer, and that was my vision of what it was going to be. I had even, you know, bought my Indiana Jones felt safari hat and my khaki shirt and all. But the rapids in the Apurimac, which is the furthest tributary of the Amazon, it is, again, the deepest land gorge on the planet. And the whitewater just comes in rapid after rapid after rapid, almost like a waterfall, a long, continuous waterfall. They got bigger and bigger until finally when we entered the deepest part of the gorge called the Acobamba Abyss, where the walls were 10,000 feet and just sheer. Sheer is the walls on the side of your house and quite narrow, sometimes only 50 yards across. That's where the whitewater really got crazy because there was simply no way that you could avoid it. There was no way out. There were no trails leading from the canyon. You couldn't climb out. If someone got injured, they'd have to be strapped on the raft, and we would simply have to run this gorge. We knew by that point that at least five expeditions had tried to run this area before. None had succeeded, and two had ended with drownings. One was a 1976 expedition, a West German expedition, well-financed, that the captain drowned 3 minutes after he got in the water. Once we got in the gorge, we realized that the 40 miles we had hoped to run in perhaps 5 days would take much longer. We were lucky to make a mile a day, and we cut rations to half and then down to a quarter. And at the same time, terrible squabbling broke out within the expedition. I had taken several swims. I took swims every day, which simply means that I was pitched out of the raft in a rapid, you know, bounced over the side one way or another. I was the left rear paddler. But boy, one day we hit a rapid that you could see it. It was a class 6, unrunnable. But there was no way around it for the raft. We couldn't portage it. And we just had to go. We shot the top okay. We got in good position on the chute right above it. But then all of a sudden, I don't know what happened. Everything went black all around me. I was freezing cold. I just felt myself being sucked. And what I assumed was down, I couldn't even tell what was up or down. I could see no light whatsoever. I tried as hard as I could to swim, and I just couldn't. The water just pinned my arms to me. Something hit me in the chest, knocked all the air out of me, and then I just knew. I knew for a fact that I was drowning. And I remember thinking quite clearly, this is it. I was a fool to come here, and this is what a fool gets. I was a dead man. And then like that, there was a moment of this peace and clarity. I kind of just gave up. I knew that there was nothing I could do. And then the river spit me out as if I wasn't good enough. And I bounced up, and I saw our lead kayaker, Jerome Turin, down below me, probably 50 yards below me, in his kayak, just waiting below the big water, and he just yelled, swim, and I couldn't even react. I was sucked back down again and bounced off the river. Everything was blackness, and I kept getting banged in the head. And I came up again, and luckily I came up right near Jerome, and he fished me out of the river, brought me over to a sandbank, and sort of deposited me there. He had to go rescue the raft crewman as well. And I just sat there and threw up for about 5 minutes. And then that night, it just came to me. I was sitting in that camp all alone and thinking, I don't know any of these people here. They have no obligation to me. If I drown, they don't have to go back to my family and friends and explain things. I was the only American. And that's when it really hit me. The only way out of there was to run that river, and I had to learn how to do it. And at the same time, the two Polish men, Piotr and Zbyszek, came to me and said, look, we're going to make it, and we're going to make sure you make it. And that was it. The expedition split shortly after that.
So you had no choice? There was no way of walking away from this once you realized how dangerous it was?
No, not in that part of the river. There was no way out. That's when I knew this, you know, this wasn't Indiana Jones. This was the real thing. And I had better start paying attention or I wasn't going to make it.
Did you feel like a jerk then? You know, like, what the heck have I done? What have I gotten myself into?
I certainly did. But I should also say that I think I realized that was a useless thing to think about.
Uh-huh.
Jerk or not, I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had to pay attention. It was a feeling of you can't relax, you can't let go, because if you make one mistake, that's it. You know, watch what these guys are doing, see what they do, see how they react, talk to them, study, learn how to be on this raft. And so it became, in that way, it became very rewarding because it was a kind of discipline. And it certainly gave me that sense of, here's real life. This is the rawness I was looking for. And the lesson of it was, if you're in that kind of situation, you don't relax.
I want to talk with you more about this expedition, but first we'll take a short break. My guest is Joe Kane, and he was part of the first expedition to run the entire 4,200-mile Amazon River from its source to its union with the Atlantic Ocean. He was the writer there to chronicle the expedition, and that chronicle is his new book, Running the Amazon. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Joe Kane is my guest, and we're talking about running the entire length of the Amazon River. Well, the people on the expeditions ended up really at odds with each other, and the person who was the head of the expedition lost the confidence of the people who he'd taken along. This kind of came to a head when Odendahl, the head of the expedition, asked you to leave. What did he tell you, and what kind of deal did he try to strike with you?
Well, he tried to sell it as a package. It focused on me, but at different points up to then, it had focused on other people in the expedition, too. He had gone to various members and tried to get them out one way or another. We all sort of realized that what was happening was that once we got through the worst part of the river, he was going to try and force us off the expedition and narrow it down to perhaps three or two men, himself, his close friend Tim, and Piotr, because he had to take Piotr.
He wanted to narrow it down so there'd be more glory for him or
I don't,
more food
you know,
for
I
him?
Really don't know. That was certainly the feeling among the other members of the expedition, that it was a very vainglorious sort of pursuit for him to attempt to get us out of there. And I think that's what caused us all to come together, because we really did stand up as a group and say, no, you are not the expedition leader anymore. It's our expedition. You're welcome to stay, but we're not going to follow these kind of rules anymore. They're not for the best of the expedition. And the man who really put that across was Jerome Turin. He was our best kayaker by far. He was an international champion. He was the one man who was never swept into the water, never really at the mercy of the river, and the man who saved all our lives again and again. He had known Odendahl. Their relationship went back many years, and he had seen this happen before. And he, once we were trapped and in bad, you know, in a bad situation, he came to me and to Zbyszek and to Piotr and said, look, clearly you guys don't know the history here, but there's a lot more going on than just us trying to get down this river. Francois is chasing some ghosts, and he will stop at no end to relieve his own inner burden. We mutinied. I think that's the only real accurate way to describe it. Although Odendahl demanded a vote of confidence, and we gave him an overwhelming vote of no confidence, and he did leave the river shortly after that.
Well, several people left the expedition. Why did it break up?
A lot of reasons. We had planned to take 3 to 4 months on the river. After 3 months, we had covered a grand total of 600 miles out of a 4,200-mile river. Given that was the worst and most treacherous water, but still, we were so far behind. We were virtually flat broke. When you look at most expeditions, the budgets are, you know, million-dollar budgets or multi-million-dollar budgets, and I think we went all the way down that river for about $25,000. Everybody was tired. Nobody was terribly sick, but people were worn down. There was no doubt about that. We had been, for 6 weeks, it had been literally every day. You'd wake up and you'd think, boy, am I going to make it through it today or not? And that the grinding that places on the personalities was, it was a big factor. And people were tired. That's it. They just left for those reasons, I think.
So finally, there were just two of you who stayed on the river the whole time, who actually kayaked the complete length.
That's right. I should say, in fairness, it really was four, in that Zbyszek, our photographer, and Kate, our doctor, Kate Durant, who was also the only woman on the expedition, they said, you know, we'll stay, and we're going to go, and we'll carry the medical supplies, and we'll carry the emergency food, and we will drop it as we can in key places along the river so that you can get it, and we'll try and join up with you all along the way. But then, yes, it came down to Piotr, who Piotr is an iron man. I can't describe him in any other terms, really. He was going to make it one way or another. He would swim the river if he had to. But he asked me, he said, look, we've got two sea kayaks here. Would you join me? I don't want to do this alone. And I figured, in for a dime, in for a dollar, we've come this far, why not? So I said, sure, I'll do it, let's go. And we set off on a journey of 3,600 miles.
What was it like after being in a mountainous region and negotiating rapids for so long to hit sea level and placid waters and to be in the middle of the jungle?
The physical difference, at least for me, was that I was no longer in this mortal fear for my life every day. But by the same token, the physical demands were much greater. We were paddling an extraordinary length. I had no idea. I had never been in a sea kayak, so I didn't know what it meant. And after the second day, I just sat there in my boat one day. I stopped, you know, it was 100 degrees out, and my head was just throbbing, and I was completely exhausted, and I calculated how far it was out to the Atlantic. And it was 3 million paddle strokes, which was, it made the act of executing a single stroke pathetic and almost useless. Physically and emotionally, it became a matter of adjusting to this routine over day after day after day, minute after minute, hour after hour. That was the most profound difference for me personally. But then the exterior was we were back sort of in the land of the living. Down in the big Amazon, there are villages, there are Indians of various types down there. And you do see, after a certain point, you do see other travelers on the river now and then. And in the big white water, we were completely alone. There was no way into that abyss and no way out of it, and people did not go down there.
What shape were you in when you finally arrived at the mouth of the Amazon where it meets up with the ocean?
I was underweight, I'll say that. I'm not big, I'm 5'10", 155 pounds usually, and I was down to about 135 pounds at that point. My wrists were inflamed. I had what is called tenosynovitis, and inflammation of the tendon sheaths in the wrist, a fairly common distance kayaking affliction. I was strong, but I was exhausted, frankly. And I would like to say that we reached the ocean with a sense of euphoria, but it wasn't that. It was a sense of, wow, well, we did it. Let's go take a nap. The real euphoria didn't set in for a few months after we got home.
What did you do the day after?
The day after? Actually, we had television crews came out, Brazilian television, and we sort of reenacted the crossing of the ocean. But the most jarring event afterwards was that we went down to Rio de Janeiro. We were given free plane tickets. We were flat broke at that point again, as we had been most of the journey. And Good Morning America contacted us down there and said, look, we'll fly you home for free if you'll be on our show. So literally 3 days after we had been camping in the mud on the Amazon, we were touring downtown Manhattan in these limousines and staying in $300 night suites in the middle of winter. It was 6 below, and it was jarring. Kate and Zbyszek and I barricaded ourselves in my hotel room and got a big bottle of wine and a bag of sandwiches and just stayed there until we were on television.
That really does sound disorienting. Your job on this expedition was to chronicle it. You know, you had hoped to come back and write a book, and that's what your purpose was. They wanted someone to write about the expedition. That's why they asked you to join.
That's right.
So I assume you were taking notes throughout the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Were you self-conscious when you were writing while you were on the journey? Like, what kind of tone should I strike here? After all, you were carrying the portable Conrad in your knapsack.
Striking dark and dark vision. I didn't even worry about it at that point. The real job, as I saw it, was to make sure I had the details down, just to get the notes down. I made myself write 1,000 words a day, every night, even if it was just about the dirt under my fingernails, just to make sure I had something down when I came back. At first it was exhausting, because I'd work all day. First it was hiking all day, and then it was paddling the river all day, and then at night I'd have to sit down and fill all these blank pages in my notebook. But after a while, perhaps after the first even 2 weeks of the expedition, when I was feeling particularly alienated from the rest of the people, since I didn't really know them, the notebooks became my place almost of refuge. It was a place I went where I knew what my job was, I knew what I had to do, and I knew how to do it. And I could sit there and write and do the work. Sometimes it meant falling asleep with my face down in the notebook and waking back up again to keep on. But it really was something that I grew to like, to look forward to in the day.
How did you manage to hold on to the notebooks, considering you were almost killed yourself? You almost drowned.
It was, frankly, it was tricky. I showed up in addition to my, you know, my safari hat and my epauletted khaki shirt, I also showed up in South America with a waterproof briefcase, which I was roundly derided for it. But once we got on the raft, that thing was a jewel. I could tuck my notebooks, and I had a tiny little micro cassette recorder, and my pens, and I could tuck them into the briefcase and tuck that in turn under the center net on the raft. And then whenever we got a break, I could yank it out and very quickly scribble down the notes, whatever my impressions were, snatches of conversation, descriptions, things like that. And then at night, go back and organize it into more of a narrative. So that became a very important tool. The other thing that I was really worried about with keeping notes was that they not be washed away and not be obliterated by the water. So I had the micro cassette recorder, and every 3 or 4 days I would read the previous sections of my diary into the micro cassettes, then wrap them in duct tape. And after a certain point, I was able to send a batch of those out by mule and back to the United States. And in fact, they all made it intact. And those were my backup notes.
That's really remarkable. Now that you're making a name for yourself from this book, Running the Amazon, in order to keep writing, are you going to have to go on more death-defying expeditions?
That's a shame, isn't it, when you have to push it that far to get a book out of it? No, I'm not. I'm certainly not enamored of the idea of risking my life for a story. This happened accidentally. I did not ever think that my life would be in danger when I first set out on it. I'd like to write a book on adventure gardening, you know, how to raise really wild tomatoes, that kind of thing. I certainly would like to go out and be in a very wild place again. But on the other hand, I don't want to have that label of, oh yeah, he's just that fool who goes out and goes these crazy places. It's nice to be, to be every man, to be just a normal person and then put yourself in a really wild situation.
Oh, can we end on one of those big impossible questions? I really would like to know if you think any more or any less about death now that you're home safe and sound.
Frankly, no, not about death so much, but I do think about direct experience, I guess, for want of a better description. I really am convinced that the whole bent of Western culture is to veil experience, and I don't say that in a pejorative way, because who wants to feel pain? What kind of fool chases that kind of thing? But by the same token, I definitely feel that we've lost something. The culture really has no tradition of a walkabout or a vision quest or anything like that, as so many indigenous cultures do, where you remove yourself from your normal life and do something wild and then come back and live your normal life, knowing what the extremes are and what the boundaries are that are out there. So for me, while I don't think about death, I do think about, just how tame am I allowing myself to be, and how can we get out there and push that envelope, I guess, a little bit more.
Joe Kane, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joe Kane's book, Running the Amazon, is published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the 50th anniversary of The Wizard of Oz, we'll talk with Al Jean Harmetz, who covers the film industry for The New York Times and is the author of the book, The Making of The Wizard of Oz. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Public TV's Alive from Off-Center will soon feature a collaboration between choreographer Marta Renzi and film director John Sayles. Coming up, Marta Renzi talks about taking dance off the stage and out of leotards. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Peter Sellers' interpretations of three Mozart operas. And commentator Maureen Corrigan relives an ordeal of operatic proportions, her latest move. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle. The House Ethics Committee that is looking into charges against Georgia Congressman Newt Gingrich will soon have more than 200 additional charges to consider against the Republican whip. NPR has learned that Arkansas Democrat Bill Alexander, who filed original charges against Gingrich, will now ask the Ethics Committee to look at a new list of charges. Gingrich says he hasn't seen the charges, but says nothing that Bill Alexander says will surprise him. The Hezbollah, a radical Shiite Muslim faction, is threatening harsh retaliation if the United States takes military action against pro-Iranian groups holding American hostages. Mike Theodulu reports from Nicosia that the group says America should think a million times before carrying out any foolish action.
Hezbollah will teach President Bush a lesson he'll never forget if he tries any foolish action. That was the message of one of the group's top leaders, Abbas Mousawi, responding to reports that America has mobilized a number of warships in the Mediterranean. There will be no limits whatsoever to our reprisal, Mousawi insisted. He didn't say how Hezbollah would retaliate, but he did refer to the 1983 suicide truck bomb that killed 241 Marines in their Beirut barracks, implying that suicide attacks, which the group has used so effectively before, would not be ruled out. While Hezbollah denies it holds any of the hostages, there's little doubt it's the umbrella organization for all the kidnapped groups in Lebanon, including the Revolutionary Justice Organization, which says it will kill American Joseph Sosipio tomorrow unless Israel frees a Muslim preacher it seized last week. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
A federal jury in Washington has found that Korean Airlines was responsible for flying too close to the Soviet Union when a jumbo jet that took off from the U.S. was shot down by Soviet fighters 6 years ago. The jury awarded $50 million to the families of 137 of the victims. Michael Richards has a report.
Under international agreements, air carriers are only responsible for $75,000 in damages for each passenger killed or injured in a plane wreck, unless there is willful misconduct. The $50 million award today is for punitive damages. They serve as a kind of punishment for misdeeds. The families, however, are still free to sue the airline individually for compensation equivalent to what the life of their relative is worth. In a legal sense, that usually means how much money the person would have made in a lifetime. All 269 passengers on board died when Soviet jets shot down Korean Airlines Flight 007 in 1983 near Soviet-controlled Sakhalin Island in the northern Pacific. Lawyers for the company say they plan to appeal the verdict. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 16 points to close at 2657.44. Advances led declines 8 to 7, volume total 182 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. For 10 years, PepsiCo Summer Fair has been a major international arts festival at the State University of New York at Purchase. But the Pepsi-Cola company announced that this year's Summer Fair would be its last. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz thinks that Summer Fair will be especially remembered for its exciting and controversial productions of Mozart and Handel operas, directed by Peter Sellers and conducted by Craig Smith.
PepsiCo Summer Fair's final season has included an extraordinary event: productions of Mozart's three great Italian operas with librettos by Lorenzo da Ponte, The Marriage of Figaro, Don Giovanni, and Così fan tutte. I saw all three in one weekend, and it was the most exhilarating, moving, and draining experience of opera I've ever had. Not everything worked. I think Don Giovanni is about an individual who is willing to risk eternal damnation to preserve his identity. But director Peter Sellers shifts the focus away from Don Giovanni himself. The setting is a dimly lit street corner in Spanish Harlem, or is it a circle of hell? And he's cast a pair of identical twins, Eugene and Herbert Perry, as the Don and his servant Leporello. At times, it's hard to find Don Giovanni in the crowd. Still, this production has overwhelming moments and some magnificent singing. Here are the Perry brothers in their Act II duet. Can you tell which one is which? Cosi and Figaro, though, are triumphantly on target. Figaro takes place in the Trump Tower, the swank penthouse with floor-to-ceiling windows designed by Adrian Lobel and lighting designer James F. Ingalls' breathtaking New York sunset are not only beautiful images, but moving expressions of the cold isolation and cruelty of power that the heroes of Figaro are up against. Sellers' realism can be shocking. In this glorious ensemble in Act II, we are practically eavesdropping on the most intimate marital problems of the Count and Countess. The act ends with a new contingent of characters arriving to complicate matters. They turn the finale into a high-stepping vaudeville routine with fancy footwork and unison arm gestures. Sellers insists on Mozart's contemporary relevance and reality, but he also reminds us that Mozart is still Mozart. Sellers' staging responds to the music in a breathtaking variety of ways, while conductor Craig Smith and the remarkable orchestra make every bar eloquent and easy to respond to. Figaro and Cosi include the Sellers-Smith nuclear family, amazingly versatile singing actors like Susan Larson, who is brilliant as both the morally bewildered Fiordaligi in Cosi and Carabino, the horny adolescent boy in Figaro. James Maddalena, who sings the Count, and Sanford Silvan, the Figaro, played Nixon and Zhou Enlai in Peter Sellers' production of John Adams' Nixon in China. There's Frank Kelly, the rare tenor who can sing and act with intelligence and style, David Evitz, Jean Omerle, Jane West, and the heartbreaking but hilarious Sue Ellen Kuzma. As Despina, the singing waitress in Cozy, Kuzma's devastating lampoon of Shirley MacLaine stops the show. In Don Giovanni, the only singer to work extensively with Sellers and Smith is Lorraine Hunt as Donna Elvira, and she's much more detailed and convincing than the newcomers. Sellers and Smith were lucky to find impressive young performers like the Perrys and soprano Dominique Labelle, but they are even luckier to be working with people who are helping them become more than just opera singers.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. Marta Renzi choreographed a sequence in John Sayles' film Liana. Renzi and Sayles have collaborated on a dance film that airs this week on the PBS series Alive from Off Center. It's called Mountain View, and like many of Renzi's dances, it takes place off the stage, and the performers wear street clothes and dance to pop music, Springsteen, Aretha Franklin, and Marvin Gaye. And, like most of her dances, Mountain View tells a story. It stars Jane Alexander and her son Jace. It's about family relationships, and it's set in a rundown family bar in a resort town. I asked Renzi if she choreographed narrative dances because of her dissatisfaction with abstract dance.
Yes, quite directly. I did used to make those abstract dances, and I still make a few, but as much as possible I try and keep them in context.
Why?
Well, partly because actually those are the dances I'm more interested in watching. As an audience member, I'm not actually all that interested in the abstract dances, so I make the work I'd like to see. I don't have that kind of body or that delight for moving, actually just for the sake of moving. I mean, there's a very, since I was a little girl, an expressive part of what's going on that's an important aspect of why I dance and why I teach other people the dances I make. And also, I think life is too short to just make art. There's a lot that goes on in my life and in all our lives, I think, that I like to refer to and to keep it out of my art because art is pure or something like that. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Your piece, Mountain View, is going to be on Alive from Off Center. You collaborated on it with film director John Sayles, who's married to your sister.
Not married.
No, I'm sorry, not but, married. I mean, he's your brother-in-law equivalent.
Exactly. I say my sort of brother-in-law and add more hyphens than the world needs.
How did you decide to collaborate together on this piece?
Well, I've always been fond of him for however 10 or more years that Maggie's known him. And even fonder probably of my sister and appreciated the work they do. I also quite practically thought that his talents and his notoriety could only help Mountain View.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've seen a lot of movies in which the dancing has been edited in such a tight and close-up kind of way that you can never see a whole body. You never even see a whole movement. It's everything's just edited before anything has a chance to settle down. Mm-hmm. I remember I went to see Hair years ago because Twyla Tharp did the choreography, and I felt like I couldn't even see what the dances were.
You probably didn't even know I was in it.
Oh, I sure didn't.
Well, I basically, the only time you'd really know it was me is when I take acid in the park and you get to a close-up of my tongue.
Well, I think that Mountain View is shot and edited really differently, and I was wondering if you also didn't like this kind of tight, taut, edited type of dancing on film.
Well, especially if you're working toward narrative, I think it's a disadvantage to get too fragmented with the body, because then you're, you know, depending upon your point of view, then what you're doing is isolating the movement rather than the context that it's in, the body for one and the place for another. I think it's also because the cinematographer that John and Maggie and I chose, Paul Goldsmith, is not at all a dance photographer. I mean, a dance cinematographer, cameraman. So his way of framing is more I guess, like cinema, and more like photography, which is one of his other sidelights.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, a lot of people have said that in Mountain View, they find some of my favorite scenes, and I think some of Paul's nicest work is from behind the bar, where the action of the dancing is interrupted by a beer pull or Jane Alexander's profile or something like that, and they are bothered by the fact that that cuts the dancers at the waist and interrupts, you know, doesn't show them the whole body as if it were on a dance stage. Well, of course, the point is it's not on a dance stage. And I love that what you see what matters about the dancers, which for me is from about their heads to about their hips.
Mm-hmm. The dances I've seen of yours aren't on the stage. They're in the street, in an auto showroom, in a swimming pool, outdoors in a park. Are you consciously trying to avoid the stage when you can?
Yeah, I do. And even when possible, when I go to real stages, I try and make them be in venues that I appreciate. But whenever possible, I've decided to make work for places where people pay attention to how it connects to their lives, and it's not an art experience that they, you know, straighten their hair and ties to go participate in.
What other limitations or what other restrictions does being on the stage bring?
For one thing, I think the audience comes with a different set of expectations. They expect it to be art and probably virtuosity. Anyway, that's the first thing that's a problem with being on a stage, is that you go, look at me, I'm beautiful, are you? Which is not what I'm interested in.
Well, when you're on stage, do you feel like you're beautiful?
Not me. Not me.
Why?
Oh, you know, I'm pregnant and I have a cold now. I feel radiant.
But not beautiful.
Even when I'm not pregnant, but I don't feel beautiful.
Well, I think that there really is an emphasis on dance and in physical beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Did that make you feel somewhat of an outsider when you started dancing, if you didn't feel that you were physically beautiful?
Sure, and you know, many people have said to me, and they mean it well, so I take it well, that until they saw my work, they never thought they could be dancers. You know, a lot of people who are not built like that, so I go, uh-huh, and what do you mean by that? But I know what they mean. They mean that not just in the ballet world, but in lots of other of the modern dance cliques, it's still, you know, there's still a certain amount of length you should have in your line, and there's a certain amount of lightness you should have in your motion if you're going to do stuff that's pure, and that makes sense. If it's meant to be pure and your personality is not meant to come through, then, you know, we shouldn't notice the size of your buttocks or the, you know, the effort it takes you to do things, probably.
So you're shorter than most dancers, right? You're, what, 5'3"?
Yeah, yeah. I'm shorter. I got short shins. I had tibia torsion when I was little, and so maybe I'm still a little bow-legged. My hair is always a mess. You know, I've gotten reviews where they say, fix your hair. You know, what can I say? I don't train to get, you know, the cuts in my muscles like Jane Fonda trainers do and like a lot of modern dancers who go to the gym do. I really train more to be available to any possibility, and then as a choreographer, I head those possibilities in other narrower directions.
I'm wondering if there are movies that influenced your style of dance, and by that I mean, something like West Side Story, in which the dancers were outside in the streets, dressed in street clothes.
I think West, you know, I loved it when I saw it, and I'm sure it influenced all of us. I didn't love it actually very much when I saw it on Broadway recently. It looked very corny to me,
mm-hmm.
and false. That didn't look like street movement in the slightest, and that bothered me. I mean, in Mountain View, one of the real challenges for me was to use as much vernacular as possible so that people watching it wouldn't go, oh, I get it, it's dancing, and put on that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But we could still not be forced to, you know, that we could still slip into some things that you don't actually see people doing in a bar, but that is, you know, pretty clearly a metaphor for what they just finished doing. Instead of, you know, doing grand jeté all of a sudden, they might do a lift that you don't actually see people do in a bar, but it has the same kind of sexiness of the move immediately before it that you might see in a bar.
As a choreographer, I think you're very aware of the sexual nature of
mm-hmm.
dance. And in some of your dances, you have, like, really clearly sexual gestures, touching breasts, touching the inside of thighs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you're consciously trying to to work with that in an overt way, to address the sexual nature of dance?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, that certainly is a part of what my body is for me. I bore one son, and I'm going to bear another child. So that I have a sense of myself as a sexual person way up there on the list of what my physicality is. It's also a slightly political statement. I made a whole dance called Soft Cell. I don't know if it's one of the ones you saw. That was about how the audience's point of view is often as a voyeur, and whether they recognize it or not, they're in some kind of pornographic relationship, especially to female dancers and their bodies. So I thought, well, okay, that is part of what's going on. Let's go ahead and recognize that and enjoy that. One of the reasons we watch other people's bodies and touch other people's bodies is because it's sexually, it's a limited word, but it's sexually pleasurable. And it's expressive, too. It's not, you know, when you were describing hands on breasts and hands in thighs, I thought, now people are going to think this is, a fat, sexy, pornographic choreographer. And I thought, well, you know, it's very expressive. That, you know, that stuff, which is maybe usually only done in intimate situations, is actually expressive also of, in my work, almost always of love and romance and all of the other things that put it in a social context, not sheer lust, I hasten to add on NPR.
Well, I always wonder how self-conscious dancers are about handling each other's bodies, mm-hmm. and the intimate places that they have to place their hands in order to do a lift, mm-hmm. or get lifted.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the kind of thing dancers talk about to each other? Or
well, sometimes they do,
that?
And there are all kinds of funny jokes. But it is something you have to learn, I think, to, like any actor does, probably, to fall in love or be lustful or whatever the occasion is at that moment, but then not necessarily to carry it home with you.
You're pregnant now. Are you going to choreograph something for your pregnant self?
Well, actually, almost on a dare, I took a job for a pretty informal performance December 11th, when I'll be a month away from birth. So, as I say, I did it sort of on a dare. I figure at the worst, I'll sit in a chair and pontificate. And at the best, I'll...
complain about your back or something?
Right, something like that. Or, I don't know, say, go, oh, can you feel it? I'll keep my hands on my belly and go, oh, it kicked. Do you see it? It kicked. At the best, I'll maybe keep myself, dancing and thinking about dancing. So, yeah, we'll see what I make.
Dancer and choreographer Marta Renzi. Her dance film, Mountain View, is featured on the next edition of PBS's Alive from Off Center. And one of her dances is being performed this week at the Serious Fun Festival at Lincoln Center. This is Fresh Air. Things are a little hectic in the All Things Considered newsroom, but I have a rundown of some of the stories they're covering. They're following the story of hostage Joseph Sisipio. President Bush renewed his call for the hostage's release. A Lebanese group said that any U.S. military action would be met with more killings. And we hear from the Iranian who is believed to be the sponsor of the Lebanese Shiite terrorists. Also from South Africa, a story about black people going to white hospitals demanding care in protest against apartheid. Many hospitals are admitting them. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For most of us, moving is a fact of life. Some of us do it more regularly than others, and it usually entails some sort of trauma. Commentator Maureen Corrigan recently went through this ordeal and shares her perspective.
This is a true story. One night, about 4 years ago, I was watching TV when an electric company commercial came on. There was this old man who was having trouble remembering to pay his bills, so the kindly electric company was offering a service to help forgetful senior citizens make regular payments. The commercial stunned me because in a background shot of the man's kitchen was a photograph of my father's family taken in the 1920s. There was my grandfather sporting a handlebar mustache, my infant father wearing a sailor suit, my grandmother and my two aunts in their communion dresses. I called the electric company and learned that a producer had bought the photo in a Philadelphia thrift shop. I should have guessed. My father's family heirlooms are scattered in thrift shops across the Northeast. You see, like many other people, my grandparents moved a lot during the Depression. In those days, desperate landlords offered a free month's rent to attract tenants. So, if you were broke at the end of the month, you would pack your things and move, usually at night, to the next apartment that offered a free month's rent. The belongings you couldn't carry had to be left behind or put in storage, though you knew you'd never get them back. Maybe my erratic family history explains my own dread of moving. Last month, I moved from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C., and prepared for the move months beforehand by denying it. Instead, I read Barbara Pym novels about English spinsters who've lived in the same villages all their lives. A week before moving day, I finally mobilized by raiding liquor stores so that I could cram my stuff into sturdy boxes of Jim Beam and Reuniti. As usual, I moved myself with the help of three friends and a rent-a-truck that burned enough gas to launch us into suborbital flight. What made this move even worse than others I've suffered through is that my friends and I had all crossed the threshold of 30. After 30, everybody has a bad back. People who used to effortlessly heave boxes now go into lumbar spasms at the mention of the names Ryder and U-Haul. But Ryder alone did a $5 billion business last year, so it's obvious that many of us need to risk traction because we can't afford professional movers. My friend Tonice has such a bad back, she travels everywhere with an ergonomic pillow. She thought she'd licked the moving dilemma a few years ago. She was moving from a basement apartment in Brooklyn to a nearby third-floor walk-up and hired a guy who advertised himself as the Samurai Mover. He claimed to strap furniture, file cabinets, and major appliances on his back and move everything in a day for $100. Only in New York, right? Well, by mid-morning, the Samurai Mover looked more like poor Butterfly, moaning flat on his back with Tonice's ergonomic pillow for support. Let's face it, moving is a drag. But if you've got to do it yourself, I think doing it with the help of whatever able-bodied friends you have left may be the least traumatic way. Friends help ease you out of the old life and into the new. After loading the truck this last time, my friends and I exchanged impromptu moving gifts. I got a cantaloupe for the road and a six-pack for the new apartment, and gave away a kitchen table and a percolator. I guess, in memory of my grandparents' Depression-era moves, I have to shed some things from the past for good luck as I'm running out the door.
Maureen Corrigan is a freelance writer, now settling in Washington, D.C. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air. Our research interns are Hillary Goldhammer, Liz Trubert, Marco Cathoria, and Andrew Kaplan. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's been 50 years since Dorothy and Toto set off to see The Wizard. Next time on Fresh Air, film reporter Algene Harmetz talks about the making of The Wizard of Oz. Also, comedy writer Alan Zweibel talks about the early days of Saturday Night Live, and Stephen Schiff reviews Parenthood. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.
Years past, St. Paul Sunday morning has proved to be very interesting in tracking the progress of some of the extraordinary young musicians who appeared on the show.